I hope you have your agendas in front of you. You see the 2018 meeting dates. Please enter them into your calendars. Any problems, questions, or suggestions about navigating the EBMS system for paper reviews and editing? Okay. I'm going to skip to JNCI news feature since that is so short. The JNCI felt like they weren't getting a whole lot of pickup from the stories that we were putting in there, the summaries, and so they have elected to drop that feature in the JNCI. And I even heard, I think, they're dropping the news section.
Yeah,
news section.
It wasn't pretty serious. It didn't have anything to do with not doing it.
Okay,
so
they...
It was just they dropped the entire news section.
I see. So they did not single us out for persecution. Okay. I like to go around feeling aggrieved, but I guess we can't. Okay.
We can't.
Yeah.
It's up to you.
All right. So now we'll get down to the, some of the content. Changes to summaries are in attachment, listed in attachment 2 in front of you. And then, as always, the levels of evidence that we use to judge the evidence. Then the comprehensive review schedule. These are our goals over the next couple of years. Okay, and skin cancer and endometrial cancer is on for comprehensive, right? I think we can move on now. Okay.
Can I ask a question? So, on number page 4, there's comprehensive revision of existing summaries.
Yes.
Hello.
And later on in the year, we have smoking cessation.
Do you have your microphone on, Pam?
Oh, I sure don't.
Okay.
So skin cancer and prevention, skin cancer and endometrial are listed here, but for 2018 to 2019. But there are a whole bunch of others on handout 4.
Those what are just listed as the next step. So that's the reason why they're on the agenda, and handout 4 sort of goes through them, but that's open for discussion about changing that. That's just sort of...
Okay, it's not like we've, like, dropped these as goals.
Oh, no, definitely we have not dropped them as goals, yeah. But we can certainly rearrange them as people see fit. So nothing is set in stone.
Oh, well, we have Jill Rubel's medical student. There were supposed to be 2, but only 1 is on the line. The other one couldn't make it. And maybe, Jill, you can introduce him?
Sure. So Conrad Wall is on the line, and he is a Williams College undergrad, pre-med, with a strong interest in bioethics and public health, who actually has run college's public health and bioethics club, which I found to be pretty interesting. And he has taken the initiative to bring speakers to campus and to have informal discussions and journal club-like meetings among students, and reached out to me through a faculty member to come up and talk some time ago and gave us the opportunity to potentially collaborate on other things and include him and some of his classmates in this meeting and hopefully in the future others. I've really been impressed by his, the interest of a young person in these issues and his initiative.
Great. Okay, welcome, Conrad.
Talk about the new board members real quick?
You have in front of you a new handout on suggested new board members. I think both names originally came from Pam, is that correct?
Well, they came from Gwen Murphy in DCUG. I don't know either of these, but she suggested them, so I can't vouch for whether they would be appropriate. I know that David said, David, you thought that one of them was it for in? No, it was Tom Vaughn.
Tom Vaughn, I've known for years, though not very well. I haven't seen him in years. He's at the University of Washington, worked with Brian Reed. He's extremely thoughtful. He's an epidemiologist about clinical applications and extremely knowledgeable in esophageal carcinoma. I think that's his main area, but he's absolutely terrific.
So, pretty well feel. Should we, I don't know, can you get a CV or some background material on him? Can we take a look? And David, does he work well with others in a committee setting?
I have had very limited experience, but the answer is yes, but that may be worth more asking around, perhaps, if there's any way to tell. My own experience with him is very limited, but I was also very impressed.
Okay.
Barry was in an EDRN site visit that I was on to Seattle, and he looked like he interacted very well with that group, but my experience was limited.
Okay. Well, then let's say, that tentatively we'll say yes, but let's take a look at his CV. And then, Misha, we can extend an invitation to him all with this one. In good shape. Anybody else know Tom Vaughn? No.
I don't. I was just asking whether people can hear me or not. I was having trouble with mine.
Okay. And who is that?
Tish.
Oh, Tim. Tish. Okay.
Great. He's in there. Lots to know right now.
Okay. Now we're moving to a bit of a tricky topic. And that is obesity and cancer risk and the issue of multiplicity. And Don, since I think you are the originator of this topic, maybe you can say a few words and we can take it from there.
Okay. I'm happy to say a few words.
I passed the screen to you, so you can share your screen if you'd like.
Okay, great. So can you see my screen?
Yep. Yes.
So I want to talk a little bit about obesity, but to say some things about other issues as well, alcohol, for example. And there are several points I want to make. One is language, the language that we use in terms of levels of evidence, in terms of causation. One is the issue of citing other people that make recommendations or assess the evidence, and that brings in other kinds of language as well. And I'll do this for both alcohol and obesity. Obesity, I'm really concerned that we may be doing harm. There's nobody in this country who is obese that wants to be obese, that doesn't try to not be obese, as opposed to alcohol and smoking, for example. And people that have cancer, as everybody knows, looks for things that caused it. What caused my cancer? And there are people out there who are obese, who have cancer, who blame themselves because they're told every day, and they see everywhere that it's obesity that's big evil. It's interesting to me that obesity has been increasing incredibly, as everybody knows. But on the other hand, mortality generally human mortality and cancer is going down. And similarly for diabetes, it's interesting that if you have an obesity drug or a diabetic drug, the thing you have to do with the regulators is do a trial to show that you're not increasing cardiovascular mortality or cancer. It's not that these things, if you lower A1C, for example, diabetes, you make somebody lose weight, it's not that people think that you're going to show lower mortality. It is that they don't want you to show increased mortality. So these are non-inferiority studies, and they're huge at 5,000, 10,000 patients. And I'm worried about fat shaming. I'm worried that what we're doing is not in the best interest of people generally. And I have specific issues. I do want to get, as I mentioned, on disease. I'll get to that. I'll get to some other issues of multiple regression analyses. In the context of the paper that I'm supposed to be doing, but I'll save my pet trick for last, the pet trick paper. So let me go to I have a lot of stuff on my screen. I'll talk about levels of evidence. So these are our levels of evidence. And the highest level is solid. We spent several years ago many meetings talking about words. So solid is the highest level of evidence. After that comes air and inadequate. And we use words in our statement that are not consistent with this, and that we use the word strong, we use convincing, and other qualifiers. We ought to be consistent with our own guidelines. The general statement, risk factors for cancer, there is a section, risk factors with uncertain associations with cancer, and alcohol and obesity fall in this group. And we say about alcohol that the strongest evidence is WC. Our FAICR report on drinking alcohol. The evidence was judged to be convincing that drinking alcohol raised the risk of cancers, as you see listed. Two things that I don't like about this. One is the word convincing. What does that mean? Convincing to whom? And the other is to whom? So this is a panel that put together this report, and we're citing it. We ought to, in almost every case in the PDQ, we don't cite other people. We go to the literature, and we assess the literature ourselves and assign them terms like solid and fair, et cetera. And the other thing I don't like about this is that even though, and I'll show you that, even though we don't attribute cause, our language is such that it implies cause. For BMI, for obesity, we again say convincingly linked to cancer, and the paper that I'm going to be talking about is the cancers in the esophagus and the gastric cardia. And this is, limited suggestive. I don't like any of this language because it's not us. the obesity, I mean, so what does that mean? All of the information about obesity is in observational studies. Now, you would say, well, what about the PLCO, the tetra here? That's a randomized trial, but it's not randomized for obesity. When one says evidence from a randomized trial, that means that the issue that you're assessing was assessed in the randomization. You were randomized to get screening or not screening, for example. So these are observational studies of historical randomized trials or cohort studies or case control studies. The issue of association versus cause, there are genes associated with obesity. We know some of those genes. Most of them, at least according to the authorities, we don't know. The assessment I've seen is that 70% of obesity is associated with genes. And it may be, you know, the metabolism genes, for example, people at 50. It may be that what affects obesity also affects cancer. We don't know that. It's a huge unknown, and so we should worry about that. What is the biology? The biology, and others know much more than I do about this, is largely unknown. I mean, one might think that simply having more cells means you have more chances for mutation, and therefore that's the issue. It's obviously more complicated than that. It's associated on learning with not fat, but with sugar, with glucose, and what drives cancer cells seems to be glucose, and even the fat even suppresses the cancer growth. So there is some evidence there, but nobody knows for sure what the mechanism would be if cancer is actually caused by or promoted by obesity. The issue of sorry, I'm just looking at my notes here. So the issue of what cancers are involved, we cite lots of cancers that are associated with obesity. We cite breast cancer as one example. So the WHI publishes a lot of papers on their study. With all sorts of subset analyses and the like, and therefore prone to, I mean, 14 publications, therefore prone to multiplicities. There, in terms of BMI, they found that on the basis of a multiplicity analysis of all the plain variables, they find this background they found that if you took HRHT, that BMI was not involved, but if you did not use hormone therapy, and that was the randomized part of the trial, that you had an increased risk of cancer. The noise is really quite bad. you have an increased risk of cancer. And that is, you know, it's obviously not something they thought was going to be the case in this interaction. It's a difficult thing to understand, and it's frankly probably wrong. But it raises the issue of the analysis that they did, and that issue of obesity and breast cancer is not something that is compelling or to me. The issues in esophageal cancer, for example, are quite different. So I think we should stick with, my proposal is that we stick with the language in our levels of evidence, that we not cite other people, but we cite the actual data. And if you read our, let me show you one thing. Oh, I should do this. This is the paper that I'm supposed to be talking about at this time, and it is a study based on two other studies, the NIH AARP diet and health study for the PLCO. And the PLCO involving 400,000 individuals, and these are the number of cases of esophageal cancer and gastric.
Let's get
I triggered Siri. She's telling me that she's something on the web for esophageal.
Siri, tell us what multiple.
And she was just sitting beside me, and I didn't touch her, and I know she's gone. And so the data really here are strong. We've known this for other studies. I think it's extremely good study. They if I can go to the conclusions. I'm losing the conclusions.
I think you may have.
So what they find is that what they look at is over time, and so they have an assessment of obesity at age 20, at baseline, at age 50. And they look at the incidence of these cancers over time. They do a hazard ratio using a Cox model, Cox proportional hazards model, with obesity time to cancer at the sensory. They consider lots of variables, and so what you see in the tables are hazard ratios by different categories. For example, let me go to one that's a little easier. This is table two, looks at a BMI, first is from BMI to age 50, looking at these various categories, there's a reference, the class, the normal BMI, then the overweight, and the obesity, and they conclude hazard ratios. Now, you might think that these would be closely related to simply what is the, these are non-cases, these are cases of esophageal, and you might think that the hazard is pretty close to this divided by this, and you can compare that to the reference thing. You'll get something not too different from this, actually. But this is based on like 17 different variables that they considered in the as covariates, and you can't actually reproduce their calculations, but it points to the problem that I was going to mention. Everybody understands the multiplicity issue. The other issue is multivariate analysis itself. So when you add variables and look at covariates, you dilute and you sometimes bias in the opposite direction a particular analysis, the particular coefficients associated with the variables in question. So there are a lot of these variables that are correlated, and some that are correlated that we don't understand that they're correlated. So you're looking at it in a 17-dimensional space at a relationship between one of dimensions. And if you add, for example, diabetes, if you look at the BM and then you add diabetes, it's going to take up some of the slack from BMI. And it's going to try to fit a surface in this 17-dimensional space, and if the individual associations then are taken up by other things, and if there is a negative association, you can even see things going in the other direction. So there's a bias associated with doing a multivariate analysis. If you ignore the multivariate analysis and just look at the numbers, you still find results that are pretty compelling. So I'm for Patrick, I'd like to see this in our statement and cited as an association, and I wouldn't include the Table 5. Table 5 looks at what they call trajectory. And the trajectory, the things that they're looking at here are, your base, for example, overweight to obese. If you start out overweight and you go to obese, as opposed to you start out normal BMI to obese, is that similar? Well, you see from here it's not too different. And in gastric cardia, it's not too different, with very small numbers. So I think this is weak, but I would include it with a statement about obesity and the associated risk. And I haven't done that, but I will do it if you agree that this should go in the statement, along with other statements, the other study groups. So I've taken too long. I've said really scratched the surface, but I'll stop there. I'm looking forward to Tony and others to come.
Don, this is Ishmael. Do you know there's always a discussion about the qualitative age interaction of obesity and breast cancer. And I don't know if you get anything to add about that. I mean, that in fact, the data are diluted because they don't take age into account. So, for example, even though obesity is supposed to increase breast cancer risk in all these observational studies, the both metabolic women dominate these studies. But if you look at age, it actually has opposing effects in the premenopausal versus the postmenopausal dose. And in premenopausal women, it actually may increase risk, certainly decrease risk, whereas in postmenopausal women, it increases risk.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. And that is, I mean, it's very much like the hormone therapy issue. So I frankly, I looked at it some time ago, breast cancer and obesity, and I thought, and also breast cancer and alcohol, and I thought the data just weren't there. Maybe they've gotten there now, but in the breast cancer, I really worry that it's a false positive, and there's obviously a publication bias, and you look for things that are positive, and sometimes, by golly, it looks like breast cancer, and it looks like obesity, so you publish that.
Well,
this is Jim, and I know the purpose here isn't to tear apart the Petrick paper, but I just wanted to point out quickly three other weaknesses. One is that they do absolutely nothing to address non-responsive visit data, which is not uncommon in these kinds of studies.
Right.
They use a sort of an outdated way of selecting variables for their multivariate regression. I appreciate what you're saying about these multivariate analyses, multivariate analyses not always being reliable, but it's particularly bad when you're selecting variables strictly based on whether they move the estimate or not.
Right.
Because it could be moving it in the wrong direction. And I think that this is a topic that's been addressed quite a bit in the epidemiologic methodology literature, saying that one should have an underlying causal model and select your covariance according to that and not whether they move the estimate or not, as a result of whether they're moving in the right or wrong direction. And then finally, there's table three. You didn't mention table three is where they try to look at change in weight, and it actually makes no sense because they don't adjust for the starting weight, and so basically all they're doing is picking up the association that, you know, they've already demonstrated the association with BMI in their main analysis, and so here all they're doing is picking up the secondhand association of change in weight, magnitude of change in weight with the underlying BMI, because obviously somebody with a high BMI is able to show bigger shifts in their weight quite easily than somebody with a low BMI. And that's sort of emphasized by the much weaker associations we're seeing. I just want to say that paper is so full of holes and sort of misguided analyses. I think we should make clear in our write-up
the last two of the things that you talked about are related to some of the things I said. For example, when I was talking here on table two about these numbers, if you do the analysis that I mentioned, just take the raw data and look, not at time because I don't know time, but look at the number of cases and in the number of cancers, you find that the risk, the relative risk, is something like these numbers that you see here. So the multivariate stuff and all of the shenanigans, statistical shenanigans, are maybe getting at something that's the right thing to get, but the data are pretty clear that if you're obese, you're more likely to have a diagnosis of cancer. And the other thing relates to the trajectory that I was talking about, you know, the change and the table five, which to my eye and to my analyses don't really answer the question that they suggest good answers. So I agree.
And same with table 4 and table 3.
Yeah.
They don't really answer the question. I'm totally supporting the idea of just pointing out the wrong results and what they suggest. I think, certainly more than all these questions.
All right, so let me first address the first part of your presentation, John. I think we have tried to be consistent, but obviously not always consistent, in avoiding referring to what other panels have concluded, with the rare exceptions that we sometimes do it for a highly controversial topic when we want to invoke another group as well as our own statement, like abortion and breast cancer. We refer to the Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, I guess it is. And likewise, if it's something where we recognize it will catch the attention of people, we want to sort of get other authorities. We have referred to a National Cancer Institute panel in the past, for example. So, but for obesity, that's not the case, or overweight, and I think we ought to strip all that language about the AICR and reference to them. The second related issue is they sometimes use causal language, and IARC, for example, uses causal language that sometimes we're not comfortable with. So I agree with you. We ought to stick to our language, talking about association. I saw the word linked to cancer, and that feels a little more causal than I think we intend. And so we need to strip out language like linked and substitute language like associated with. Sometimes, if it's very, very consistent, we can say consistently associated with, but I don't think we should say linked unless we intend to say there's a causal link. Now, to this paper, so it sounds like the two of you have come to an agreement on how to handle the actual data and the presentation. But still, this is nothing more than association. And as you know, since a whole lot more people start one weight and gain weight than start at a high weight and lose weight voluntarily, we still, it doesn't get at the issue of whether or not there's even an association between losing weight when you're overweight and reducing your risk of cancer. And I think we ought to make that statement somewhere when we're dealing with weight. Go ahead, I'm sorry, Tim?
Yeah, I was just going to support what you were saying about losing weight. None of the trajectories they examined even had to do with losing weight, so it's not helpful.
Right. And so I think it's a good idea to point out that that's a gap in knowledge, even for association, much less causation. So that,
I agree.
Okay, so I think we can move on. Don, I guess you are going to craft some language about the Petra paper. Can you pass it by Tim before you send it to Alicia?
Yes.
Okay. Are there any other comments about that the presentation? Okay, and to the issue of multiplicity, you pointed out things like collinearity and putting in cofactors that are variables that bias or create an unstable estimate, and that's fair enough. But the other issue of multiplicity that I'm not sure you were alluding to is that over generations, any school of public health worth its salt will have a database that goes back decades, and every year they have a new wave of postdocs or PhD candidates who come through, and they're all turned loose on the same database, and they come up with all sorts of associations that haven't been explored before. You know, very unusual cancers, for example. And that's a clear case of multiplicity, where you come up with, given enough time, you'll find some chance associations over time. I don't know if that's pertinent to this, it's likely not, but we ought to be aware that it's easier to get a paper published when you say overweight and obesity are associated with cancer of the, I don't know, lip or whatever, than it is to get it published saying that it's not associated. And so that is multiplicity-driven publication bias.
Yeah, so we've talked before about studies that are milked to death. I think the WHI qualifies with over 1,400 publications. There's no question that many, if not most, of those publications are wrong. But of course, the problem is we don't know which they are. In any case, those and other similar studies are overhyped, I think.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how to immunize ourselves against it except to not refer to those papers, but a paper just came out from the Nurses' Health Study and the Physicians' Health Study from the Harvard group that has that database and has been, I would say, dredging it for many years. And they came up with a new index. It was called an inflammatory diet, where they associated specific foods with C-reactive protein, and then they came up with an index of a diet that was likely to increase the so-called inflammatory index, and reported that it was associated with colorectal cancer, and that hit the news. But when I looked at the actual foods that they put into as raising the inflammatory index, some of them have been reported previously as protective against cancer, and some of the ones that lower cancer risk were reported to increase the index. And so they had a real mix, an uninterpretable mix of foods that they purported to say increase your risk of cancer or decrease, or lack of them, decrease your risk, when in point of fact it goes against studies that show an association in the opposite direction. So, as an example, for some reason, alcohol came up as protective because it's got a low inflammatory index. We come across this all the time. Some meats went in the other direction. And it made it uninterpretable to me, but it got a lot of press you got to avoid. And if you were to tell the public, be sure that you avoid an inflammatory diet, they'd have no idea what that means. So it's a long way of saying when you dredge a database for years and years and you keep thinking of different measures, you can come up with some very surprising and unreliable results.
So I have a principle that I enunciate frequently that nobody understands or believes, and it is that the more you analyze a data set or a database, the less confidence you should have on your observations.
Yes. I guess it's academic overthinking or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have...
So I do want to mention one other thing. I think there's an absence of a paper that would be good to include somewhere. Of course, I'm telling my own where. But Bernard Levine and I did a really comprehensive meta-analysis in colorectal cancer looking at risk factors. And one of the things I said about alcohol, we attribute, by the way, the word attribute was also suggested with causing. We attribute alcohol to causing or promoting or being associated with colorectal cancer. And in the analysis that we did here, we found no association, and it's a comprehensive set of 22 studies involving thousands of cases, cohort studies, as well as case control studies. But this paper and obesity, or BMI, we do find the same thing that everybody else found.
Yeah.
And so I just want to mention that this, for the colorectal cancer folks, this is something that should be somewhere.
Yeah, I agree, but this paper I just referenced made note that alcohol is part of a low inflammation diet, and so the more you drink, the less colorectal cancer you have, at least according to their analysis. So it's all over the place, the state of dredging. So I think we need to move on. We're way behind.
I'm sorry.
You're going to work with Tim and get Nisha some wording to send around. Okay. So I don't know if we can achieve economy of time in the next step. But Pam, you have liver cancer prevention?
I wrote it. What do you think? let me add a little more to that. So I was able to get a pretty solid draft of the whole thing. I thought it was going to take till our March meeting, but I decided to motor through on it. I didn't have a chance to do a thorough check for consistency between the summary part and the description of the evidence part, so I still need to do that. You may have noticed the references are not really in yet, but we've got a pretty much done liver cancer prevention summary. David and I spoke this morning, and he talked about some things that might be useful to add. While I agree with him, I think what we need to focus on is getting a new statement up on the website, because what's up there right now is inadequate. And I think that the topics included here and the review of literature is pretty much good to go and is a million times better than what we have.
Okay. Having read it, I went through it, and I agree with what you just said, and it would be nice to do it sooner rather than later, and I'll leave that to Richard to see when it's ready. I did have a couple of comments.
Sure.
Very quickly. You say, under interventions with adequate evidence of decreased risk, I wondered, although this is not an issue for Americans, but at least my reading of the literature is that removing aflatoxin from the food supply, as they've done in certain areas of China,
right,
and actually achieves the level of cause and effect.
Right, and that's in, that should be in the aflatoxin
part. Well, on page 7, you don't list it.
Okay, so page 7 is still the, that was the first bit that I wrote. It's the summary. But
okay.
If you look on page 13,
okay.
Successful efforts to significantly reduce the amount of aflatoxin. So the question is, like, where do statements like that belong?
Yeah.
So, you know, it is an intervention. David and I talked about this morning. It is an intervention.
Yes.
In many ways, a lot of risk factors can be turned into interventions like removal of this.
Yes.
So where do we
across.
Well, in this case, mm-hmm. we actually, this is why I answered, there is actually an intervention where they change the crop system in a whole area of the country.
Well, they gave them the option to buy rice.
Well, yes. They changed their food supply. And this was a geographic area.
Yeah, they changed their food supply.
Surrounded of high liver cancer, surrounded by an island of high liver cancer, was surrounded by low liver cancer.
Yeah.
And all they did was change the food supply to that of the surrounding area, and liver cancer went down.
Right. So I can make that an intervention.
Okay.
All right.
And Lisa, I'm going to give you this. So, good. Thank you.
I had a comment.
Okay.
First of all, nice job. Secondly, on page 7, you talk about those interventions with adequate evidence, and then you talk about the HPV vaccination and a cluster randomized trial. I didn't see a description of the trial anywhere in the
okay.
later.
Okay. So,
is
that the end?
Maybe
page 7. Page 7 under HPV.
Yeah.
Randomization. So I will double check that. That's one of those inconsistent things that I wanted to look for.
Okay, any problems with moving toward entering this as the statement? Delivered? Okay, good.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Now, maybe we can catch up with even more time. Joanne, skin cancer screening.
I'll be very quick. Lisa will pull up the addition. This is from our discussion on one of the prior meetings. I found whenever we add a couple of sentences on papers, the text gets a little bit ragged, so I suggest addition of a little introductory sort of overview sentence. And I already see two edits I want to make. I agree with Dawn that words matter, and so I would ask Lisa to take out my first word, extensive, and just start that first sentence with observed variability, has been noted. And then the second addition is that I would add in 95% CI in the parentheses. And then I also have to say that I love being on this committee because the attention to details, discussing the limitations of studies, and providing measures of is important. And I have to tell the group that I had sent something else to Don early this morning, and he pointed out how we, as you all know, discuss measures of uncertainty in the data. And so I included for you to see how I had initially worded this. I was just going to say, oh, about one biopsy, the melanocytic lesions might have a different diagnosis than reviewed by experienced pathologists. And I thought, no, I need to add the actual estimate of 95% confidence interval. So thank you, Don.
Great. Thank you. Any comments about that? That's an important observation, I have to say, Joanne. That should get, if there's any justice in the world, that should get a lot of attention. Okay. Thank you. Now, we're going to move on to the cancer screening overview. Leslie, you had comments.
Can you hear me?
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Okay, good. All right, so I was reviewing the Trousseau paper that Pam actually did a fantastic review of and presented it at the last meeting. But I volunteered to just put a few words in there as cancer prevention screening to acknowledge that paper. And so when I reviewed the cancer prevention overview, I realized that I thought it needed some rewriting because it was very wordy and very wordy. And so I just sat down the first couple pages. So I have so much noise here. I don't know. Okay. I don't know what that is. Anyway, so I just did the first two pages as just revising what we already had and making it shorter. And then the work that I was supposed to do, as you can see, is on page 8 of this handout. And basically, I just rewrote one sentence and added the unprovoked venous thromboembolism and added the reference. And that's all I did.
Thank you. I have a question or comment. Most of this is just typos, suggested words, nothing that I'm going to give to Alicia. But at the top of the page, page 2, you say, and we're talking about cancer screening overview, that fourth and most prevalent harm is overdiagnosis. I don't think that overdiagnosis is nearly as common as some of the other things, like false positives, false negatives.
Certainly not as common as false positives.
Yeah, so I crossed out and most prevalent. I said fourth is overdiagnosis.
Okay.
Then a little bit, we have the resident expert in the world sitting in this room, and that's Jennifer, because you refer to her paper on cumulative false positives in the third paragraph, the bolded paragraph. You say after 14 tests over 3 years, I think it was more years. It was like 5 to 6 years. Am I wrong, Jennifer?
I think you might be wrong, because they got a baseline test and then it was annual.
And then annual, but screening went on for more than...
Oh, yeah, I mean, there's a longer follow-up.
That's what I mean.
But they may have 14 tests in 3 years, and they had more tests than that.
Oh, did they have more than 14 tests over the first 3 years? Because I thought 14 was the maximum number of tests you could get while you were being screened.
Well, let's see.
Well, let's see. I mean, because there were four. I mean, there's you get up to four tests per screening. I mean, so you wouldn't get them every year, though, because FlexSafe, the most you could have that was twice in that period.
Right. So, for example, sigmoidoscopy, and for many people, didn't take place. The second sigmoidoscopy
would have taken place
until the fifth year.
That's right.
And likewise, the PSA, they were doing annual screens, but it went beyond the first 3 years. And I don't think in the paper we cut it off at 3 years, did we? And by the way, 14 tests is the maximum a man could get and also the maximum a woman could get.
Right, because she had shared results.
Yes, because they were getting different screens for different cancers.
That's right.
So I think that I know that the graph in the paper showed cumulative rise with each test.
That's right.
And it was by test, not by time. But I think the time extended beyond 3 years.
You could get 14 tests in 3 years. You could get four rounds of screening.
There was the potential to get that many in 3 years. But it's like you're both kind of right. So you could theoretically get it within 3 years of screening.
Too much.
Yeah.
I mean,
but you didn't
need
it.
Right. Like, potential benefits and harms. There's one paragraph on benefits. And then it goes on and on about these harms and these real little details about some specific trial or study. I mean, it seems like it's way unbalanced. I mean, you go with some really little detail about some specific trial and some false positive rate in this overview, and you have, you know, 5 lines about benefits or less. One paragraph, only like one sentence about benefits.
It seems like it's for what are the benefits?
Well, it's just way, it gives an impression that it's just way not balanced. Like, you know, this is the benefit and this is the harm in terms of tech.
That's one benefit that goes unmentioned in that first paragraph, and that's that for CRC and cervical.
Yeah, I was going to say that also.
They're actually protective.
Yeah.
That needs to be given some visibility in that.
All right.
So, I mean, in an overview,
you mean
there's
just
way
more granularity about it?
About harms in an overview. Just say, you know, these are the harms. But don't go into all these, you know, specific trials and all these details. I mean,
I think that's probably fair. I don't know if you need this level of granularity about it.
Well, I'm just wondering out loud, and we'll get a sense of the room. Everyone assumes the benefits. They actually over-assume because they think it saves lives, even when they don't have that evidence in hand. And just to say that, yes, that there's a benefit, although the decreased incidence is also a benefit that needs to be mentioned. But very few people know about the harms at all. They even assume there are no harms. And there are harms that bear explanation, maybe not in this degree of granularity, but there are harms that a lot of people don't think about. I don't think that people recognize, and certainly not clinicians, that over a period of so many years, 3 years or whatever it is, there is a better chance than not that you're going to have a false positive, and it's useful to put the evidence in there that shows that. And the same is true for overdiagnosis, which is almost counterintuitive to a lot of people. So is there a way to achieve the benefit? It goes without saying. Screening has been shown in some cases to decrease the risk of dying of that disease, and has been shown in some cases to decrease the risk of even being diagnosed with invasive disease. In exchange for that, there are a list of harms that maybe a little bit more detail, and by necessity, because it goes against intuition, it will take a little more text. Can you live with that?
I mean, it's fine to describe the different kinds of harms. I'm just going into details about specific
trials.
Okay. We don't say, okay, in this breast cancer trial found this reduction in mortality. And
okay.
Found this.
All right, then let me see if this is a good way to go about it. First of all, maybe based on what Jennifer just said, we should just delete over 3 years of screening, because it wasn't always over 3 years of screening, correct?
I think what Paul's saying is there a way to collapse all of that down to maybe when you're talking about false positives, you can say, and they can be common, up to blah, 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 up to a cumulative rate of about whatever percent, and then just be done with it.
So here's what I would suggest, because I think that's a good suggestion. We accept this text, but Leslie, work with Pam on condensing
me.
You're on there.
Well, because I wrote
it
late.
This was not,
let's do that.
Pam's like, I can't wait.
I wasn't even in chat.
No, I did. Pam wrote
it. Hello. Let me make another try at it. As I said, when I started reading of this, you'll see what I did write was a big condensation of what was in here before. I mean, I cut down a whole page out of what was in here before, and I can cut down further. That's my best thing. So I'll add the stuff about the survival of some cancers, the different incidence of some cancers in screen populations, namely cervix and colon. And I will cut this down further and present it again next time. But maybe we can use this in the meantime.
That's good.
I think page 14.
14 I have comment, but it's trivial, and Alicia now has it in her hands.
Love trivial comments.
Okay, lung cancer screening. Jennifer, the Pachi paper.
Oh, yeah, so what I did here. I'm sorry.
Yeah?
I'm sorry, I was on mute and I was trying to break in here. I did have one comment on the section on page 8.
Okay.
And maybe it's from my perspective on this, where I work, but the statement, the first statement, the first added statement, individuals at high risk, individuals, it should be, at high risk for cancer include those with exposure to carcinogens, and they just said smokers. And I think it's important to emphasize that exposures are both environmental as well as occupational. And so I would recommend we say that with exposure to carcinogens, either environmentally, smokers in parentheses, or occupationally, and
that's
something like asbestos.
That's good.
I can add that. I'll take care of that.
Okay. We're up to item number 9, Jennifer, lung cancer screening statement, and you have edits on page 6 and page 10. We're just new reference.
Yes, we just talked about the Italong trial last time, and I thought if we were going to do that, we really should add in all the other little tiny European trials, because we didn't. So I just added references along with that one.
Okay, good.
To be thorough.
There's meta-analysis that doesn't include Italong. It works, but in meta-analysis.
Oh, I just did the primary ones, but yeah. I mean, theoretically, we could.
It doesn't include it.
Throw that.
Well, it's easier just to include the individual papers, but why don't you take a look, Jennifer, instead? Okay. Maybe next board meeting, there's a paper that just came out that I know Paul doesn't like, but it was the VA so-called real world experience on low-dose CT.
Did we talk about that already?
Well, the original paper came out a little while ago.
This is like a secondary analysis
of the VA data.
Not the original.
Right.
It just came out.
We may have that on the docket too, but I know Paul had some comments about their accompanying editorials and also a paper, short paper on, I would say, overuse, that is screening people at very, very low risk, even never smokers. Mm-hmm. And so that might bear discussion, that package of there's actually five papers also. I sent them to Alicia. Okay, now we're on to item number 10, I believe, colorectal cancer screening. And this is David.
Yes, so on page 6 of the summary, we agreed last time to add a reference about the review of all-cause mortality. We see colonoscopy reduced if the answer is yes. It's quantitatively small, but statistically significant. So we added the sentence on reference, page 6.
Good. Now we can move on to ovarian cancer. Sorry.
Can I make a quick comment?
Oh, yeah, sure. Tim?
Tim, sorry. David was making this change to sort of force me to reread the whole thing, and I did notice on the bottom of page 6, there's something that's a little confusing, and I think I know what it's supposed to be, but I wanted to clear it with, you know, with somebody. It says, the last paragraph of the Minnesota trial, which was on my mind, colorectal cancer screening with GFOBT, rehydrated FOBT every two years of control. And I think that GFOBT, rehydrated FOBT is a little ambiguous, maybe? That
it is.
Yeah. So maybe just say unrehydrated slash rehydrated, if that makes sense. Or maybe just say rehydrated, and maybe in parentheses say with, you know, some small percentage of the
That's even better.
Okay, good. Send that wording to Alicia, please. All right. Now, Alicia, I think we're going to ovarian cancer prevention.
That one sentence in bold about quantitatively small improvement in all-cause mortality. I mean, there's no difference in, the sentence says there's no difference in all-cause mortality between control groups, although a recent review suggests a quantitatively small but statistically significant improvement in all-cause mortality. That seems like it's a contradiction. Anyway, you can say that.
Yeah, I think it is, because I think
there's no difference.
I think there is a difference. That additional paper did a reanalysis of some of the data. It wasn't in the publications above that, so it does contradict the earlier data.
Okay, but it seems like it's clear what happened. You know.
A different twist in the analysis. We might solve this by saying there is little or no meaningful benefit, and then just include that reference with the others. Because it was very small.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Okay.
Maybe the same.
Okay. Is that a big compromise?
Small, right?
Yeah. Well, little or no. At most, a small. Yes. At most, a small.
The original analysis was wrong or something.
Well, we don't know if that and those analyses were wrong, or this one was
wrong.
We should point out that it would be expected to be small.
Yes.
I mean, colorectal cancer is only
25%
of mortality.
Yes, you can say, although.
If you reduce it by a third, you expect the overall effect to be small.
Yes.
But the fact that I think for any screening, if you find a significant overall mortality difference, you know, in a meta-analysis for individual, but it's important to say that because you don't easily find that.
Mm-hmm.
But however, an obviously it's going to be small.
Okay. I think that's fair enough. All right, change the wording accordingly. I think you have a sense of the room. Now we're moving to ovarian cancer prevention, number 11.
Sure, so this is two minor changes to the current document based on the Kuchenbacher paper that was previously reviewed. If you look on page 5, we basically changed the sentence to family history and mutation within the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes may contribute to risk of cancer development among those with inherited predisposition. We don't go into significant detail because there's a completely separate genetics section that goes into much more detail. Accordingly, on page 12, there is a similar and related change under the section of family history and inherited susceptibility. We discussed how the risk can be influenced, again, by the specific mutation within the gene, as well as family history of cancer, even among people with BRCA1 and 2 mutations.
Very good.
Larissa, just a comment here. This is Doug Levine. One technical thing. The reference is the same article that has two different numbers. One is footnote 1 and one is footnote 5. But more substantially, I think I might have missed the discussion on the actual paper, but I just took a quick look at it. And for ovarian cancer, it seemed like the data was negative for both family history and mutation location for modifying risk, according to the statistical analysis. They do comment that there may be an increased risk because the sample size is small, but I don't think they show data to support the claims.
I'm going to go back to the...
Maybe we can double check it offline and get back to Alicia later.
Sure.
Great.
I think in the original one, I think the language I submitted may have been a little bit softer, like may. I think the word may have been included and that may have been edited out. So I'll have to look at that.
Yeah, but the paper itself says in the results section, it says there is no association for either of those things.
I'll go back through it and I'll send you, and we'll go back and re-review.
Okay, we could follow up by email.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks. Now, Don, you're on again.
Sorry, I'm on again.
Yeah, prostate cancer screening, item number 12. Oh no, you and Tim, both.
Oh, so I missed that. I was looking for it. I'm sorry I'm not prepared, but maybe Alicia can put up what I wrote and what we discussed. Or Tim and others, and Kevin Dar.
Kevin is not here. Tim is on the line, of course. So, Tim?
Sorry, I was muted again. We did this some time ago.
Well, it was after the last meeting, and we put something together and passed it around, and the proposal is specific to prostate cancer, but it has an implication on, Kevin Dodd and I have been charged with doing something on multiplicity and various statistical things, and this is something that might fit in with it.
All right. Pages 8 through 12. And talk about the randomized trials. Then, so I had just very, very minor comments. Someone posed the question, I think it was you, Don, that's in italics, that says you think we should not give the as-treated analysis is here, and the as-treated analysis here. I agree with that. Does anybody object? Because as you know, the authors put all their emphasis on the as-treated analysis, but Don suggests that we not include that as-treated analysis here. We do the as-randomized analysis or report the as randomized analysis.
Well, is the purpose to explain the problem, in which case you have to include the as treated to compare with the correct one, or is it just to report the correct results?
Well, my take is that they're reporting just the results because they're listing all of the trials and what they found.
Okay, well, in that case, you would leave it out.
Okay. All right. And then on the next page, 12, Tim made a comment, can research studies demonstrate how large self-selection bias can be? And he gives an example of the Minnesota trial that colorectal cancer mortality in the usual care arm was less than half that of the general population in the first couple of years of the study. I thought it was a good idea, but what did the others do?
I mean, for that, I mean, you don't have colorectal cancer by definition, so that's not really self-selection. But we did the healthy, you know, healthy volunteer effect for North American studies with a more of an issue.
Yeah, that's self-selection.
Right. I mean, a lot of some of the European trials are population based, so less of an issue.
Yeah, the POPO picture would fit perfectly here for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the problem is a lot of times people kind of wave their hands at self-selection, thinking it's a minor sort of academic concern. But I think it's, you know, that's because they're never confronted with actual estimates of it.
So I think so.
So Tim, and this is a prostate cancer statement, right? So
yeah, I was in controversy. I don't know if you. I guess we could look at the PLCO. Paul, did you publish something on
healthy?
I mean,
I'm trying to remember.
We did a general thing about healthy volunteer effect, but specifically for prostate cancer, we looked at sort of the expected mortality rate in a population that starts without prostate cancer, and it was maybe half. I mean, it was the observed rate was maybe half the expected. So that's some. Selection bias probably for screening.
So there's also the classical example from the HIV trial where the women who refused screening were very different from the women who accepted screening. Mm-hmm. So if we wanted to put several references, then we could do that, but PLCOs maybe more recently.
Yeah, they don't, those kind of papers don't get as much play as the sort of results of observational studies that are probably greatly affected by selection.
So I like the idea of inserting a few sentences. This is a prostate statement, and if we have a prostate example, that works the best. But you're right. Very few people appreciate how powerful the bias can be. Okay, so I don't know. Who wants to insert that? Tim, do you want to insert it?
Yeah, I'll insert some text. Anybody who has a good study they'd like me to cite, go ahead and just send me an email.
Okay, I might send you some papers or tests, yeah.
Okay. Okay, now Jenny is going to talk about the head and neck squamous cell cancer prevention statement. Jenny?
Hi, everybody.
The
last time when we met, we pretty much tripled the area covered. We were covering the all-body neuroscience, and we added nasopharynx, hypopharynx, and the larynx, upper larynx. I followed up with an additional question to the group about since there are actually now. We've got five sites in other whether we should change the name of these courses, because head and neck squamous cell cancer also includes the thymus, for instance, or the orbit, or the parotid gland. The suggestion was to call it. Was it oral cavity, pharynx, and larynx, was it?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
And then the other question was whether we should really divide up this summary into further summaries. The only one that stands out here that's different is Mayo's son, because otherwise the risk factors for the Orotagi, Orotagi, Patasanti line is very similar, but Mayo's son in itself is a completely different one. What is the great thing? It would be a very short section on Mayo's son.
Any other suggestions? Any problems with that?
So what are the risk factors for nasopharynx? Is it that those don't include the viruses?
Well, the nasopharynx is really isn't much EBV, and smoking is not a factor, and alcohol to a very a small amount of risk with alcohol. Whereas all the others are more smoking, HPV.
I'm probably going to regret saying this, but I'll say it anyway. I found it more useful when this summary statement was separate, was organized by anatomic site. And now it's organized by risk factor and only the relevant anatomic sites are listed for that risk factor. This was tough.
It was only Orotagi and Orotan that we funded, so it was originally one time. And now we're lumping additional cancers under the new.
So I looked, head and neck squint. So when you said nasopharynx, I was like, oh, let me look for the nasopharynx section. And then I couldn't find the nasopharynx section.
It was next.
I'm sorry, what? What, Jenny? I can't. Could you speak a little louder?
It was never organized by section.
Well, it was.
It was.
I separated oral cavity and oropharyngeal. It wasn't like it was. It was pretty much two summaries in one. It wasn't like two distinct summaries in one, but each. Where relevant, the header included that anatomic part, subset. I know we've discussed this one a lot. It's not easy because it's five, are we up to five distinct regions that share many risk factors but don't share them all. So how is the best way to organize it?
I'd probably say, my suggestion is to take maybe
take nasopharynx own summary statement?
Just separate.
Separate or delete?
I don't think Jenny is saying you delete it. Jenny, what?
I mean, how would that look in there?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing that began this entire rewrite, was
right.
The research on the nasopharyngeal cancer.
Up front here in the overview, you would see
right.
That it became a separate section on nasopharynx.
So let me just understand what that'll look like. So if we look just at the table of contents on this thing, so it would say factors with blah, 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 increased risk of head and neck squamous cell carcinoma except nasopharynx, and then factors with for nasopharynx.
Jenny, could you turn up your microphone? I'm having trouble hearing you.
So there will be risk factors for oropharynx, hypopharynx, and larynx, and then nasopharynx would have a separate section.
So you'll have different sections for oropharynx, I'm sorry, for the four, are we at three or four? Larynx, pharynx, oro, I don't know, it sounds like you have something in mind, so maybe if you sketch it out, maybe that would be a way to go.
Yeah, I didn't raise it. Alicia, you said somebody raised that they wanted to separate it out.
Yeah, so when we were looking at the new title, Head and Neck Squamous Cell Cancer, from a search engine optimization, so most people get their information by Googling specific phrases or different types of cancers. No one Googles head and neck cancer. They're going to Google their specific, they're going to search for their specific type, and so we just wanted to make the title a little more specific so that it people get the information. So
okay, that sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
So changing the title is given, and then having a little, so that means we will have a separate section of nasopharynx somewhere in there.
Yeah, so, sure. I mean, it is complicated. So,
yeah.
So we may need to talk more about it, maybe Pam and Jenny and I, about how to arrange it.
No, I'm deferring on this one.
Yeah, liver really has finished me off for at least a few months.
Okay.
Yeah. So just Jenny and I will work on that.
Jenny is the resident expert.
She's also updated some images, and it's been great. So
okay.
It's very complicated.
While we're on that section, though, I have a question, and here I could very well be wrong, but on page 4, under human papillomavirus infection, the first paragraph says that HPV is a sufficient but not necessary cause. And I thought that most people infected with HPV are not known to get cancer. So it, therefore, am I wrong? Doesn't that mean it's not sufficient to get cancer?
That's
probably my language, so if I got it wrong, I take credit for that.
HPV may be a proximate cause or something like that, but it is not, to my knowledge, the overwhelming majority of people who've been infected with HPV never are diagnosed with that with the cancer. And so,
would we?
You can say the same about germs.
Would you say the same about tobacco and lung?
Yeah. So
it's unnecessary but not sufficient.
No, it's not necessary.
Neither one.
And it's not sufficient.
So maybe there should be better.
Well, maybe
that language.
You just remove that language that it's sufficient. You know, it's sufficient but not necessary.
But I think what
it is a cause. You know, and you say that based on solid evidence. Infection causes oropharyngeal. We can just omit the next sentence.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what I was going with there. I can't remember.
Maybe they were trying to say is there are other causes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Because for cervical cancer, HPV, I think, virtually rises to the level of necessary for cervical cancer. Not for head and neck cancer, because many people with head and neck cancer don't have HPV infection. So why don't we just omit this?
That's fine.
Okay. All right. And then everything else is minor words with Alicia. Okay. Now we're on to breast cancer prevention, number 14. And this is Ishmael. Ishmael?
Yes. Yeah, so you wanted me to present two papers, is that correct?
Well, you're I think for now you're just going to page 13. your added text.
Okay, so people go back that can you please show me the text of that? Because I emailed it to the Facebook screen, but it might be.
It's up on the screen now. You should be able to see it.
You see it?
Yeah. So maybe this is the estimate paper. So I said maybe the estimate involved utilized the 70 gene nanoprint assay and identified 15% of patients at ultra low risk, with 20-year disease disease survival rates of 97% and 94% in the tamoxifen control groups, respectively. Thus, these patients have extremely good outcomes with surgery alone. The frequency of ultra low risk cancers in the screen population is likely around 25%. And two, does the 70 gene nanoprint assay might be utilized in the future to identify these cancers and by reduce the risk of over-treatment. So basically, this gets the heart of over-diagnosis. Screening now is known to result in over-diagnosis. This is a potential tool or something like it, a potential tool of the future of identifying patients who are potentially at risk for being over-diagnosed and thereby avoiding unnecessary treatment, additional treatment for these patients.
That's the language
that I added in response to the assessment article.
Isn't that more relevant for the screening section?
I'm sorry?
I think that'd be more relevant for the screening section than prevention.
Yeah, I agree with Paul.
This is the over-diagnosis section. This is the over-diagnosis section. That's where it has,
But over-diagnosis
This is the breast cancer prevention chapter, right? Isn't there a separate breast cancer screening chapter where they go into the harms of
screening,
including
that should be in screening.
Lisa, just left that text. Okay, thanks. And now you're on again with the March paper.
So basically this is a study it was a prospective study from Denmark that looked at hormone contraception and risk for breast cancer. Just kind of as a background, there have been a lot of other case control studies that have shown positive associations with the use of oral contraception and breast cancer risk, but they were generally conducted when with estrogen alone. But this study actually looked at more contemporary factors of estrogen, progesterone, and contraceptives. What they did is they looked at hormone contraceptives, categorized them as current users, or recent use with discontinuation within the previous 6 months, or previous use discontinued for more than 6 months. And from about 1995 to 2012, with a median of 10.9 years, they looked at a total of 19.6 million person years. There were 11,570 incident cancer cases. And it accumulated about 1.8 million women ages of 15 and 49 years of age. So a lot of this stuff is summarized in the table. But compared with women who had never used hormone contraceptives, the risk of breast cancer among all current users and recent users was 1.2, so very small association, very small association with regards to the use. And the after discontinuation of hormone, the risk of breast cancer was still higher among women who had used hormone contraception for 5 years, or 5 years or more, and among women who had never used the active overall cancer diagnosis on current recent users was 13. So there'd be one extra breast cancer case for every 1,690 women using hormone contraception in 1 year. So I just want the issues, of course, with this is, again, this is an association, and, you know, it's not a very strong association, obviously. You know, the concern I always have about papers like this is unmeasured confoundance. And so, you know, I think even though they argue, they've taken into account unregistered founders, that a hypothetical unregistered founder, you know, according to the study, authors would need a 50% prevalence in the population, increased risk of breast cancer by factor 3, increased chance of using hormone contraceptives at 0.5. They think unregistered founders are an unlikely effect here. You know, I think it cannot completely be excluded because it's not a robust association. It's a small association, a small increased risk. And I think the concern for unregistered confounders is still at play because of the very nature of this type of study. And I think even if we accept this study at face value, I think the risk of increased breast cancer risk with regards to contraception should be weighed against important benefits of hormone contraceptives, the efficacy and of course the reduced risk of ovarian cancer, endometrial cancer, and perhaps colorectal cancer, which the authors point out also. So I think it should be included, obviously, in the because of the high profile paper from the England Journal of Medicine, I think it should be included. But I think the caveat of you know, the symbolism of association, we can't necessarily say for sure this cause and effect association and that unmeasured confounders might be at play as well. I think those factors need to be mentioned in the discussion of this paper.
That sounds reasonable. Any comments?
What page is our current text on regarding oral contraceptives? Anybody happen to know? Okay, page 26. What I'm not crazy about with this study is that they're looking at cancer risk in a really wide range of ages, and it could be the association could be different in women, say, who are 25 or 30, and women who are 45. They say something about they've got tables for less than 35 and over 35, but those, they're in the supplemental appendix. And my feeling is that if it's in the appendix, it means it's not, means they didn't think it was important enough to put it in the article. I think if we do include it, I would say give it a sentence, and that's about it.
Can you live with that, Ishmael?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it has to be included because, you know, this is a high-impact journal, the James and New England Journal, so I think it has to be included. But I think the points are, number one, at the end of an association, you know, we can't take cause and effect because it's not a randomized trial. And the association is very weak. It's not a strong association, so that, I think, you know, is another issue. And then the whole issue of, you know, even though they were alluded to this, I think the issue of unmeasured confounders. I mean, I think that can't be, you know, labored off. And then, of course, you know, we have to bring up the point also that, and the author point this also, that there are benefits, potential benefits of oral contraceptives that may outweigh risk.
Yeah.
So I think those things that need to be mentioned as well, and they do allude to that in the text of their article. So I think that's probably going to be.
Are the results from this article consistent with the text that's in there right now, or do they, or did they find something different?
No, I think other studies from what I gather here have also shown the same association. There is an association between. But here, now they're looking at the progesterone effect, which is kind of a more contemporary factor. So they're looking at progesterone having an association. You have the estrogen progesterone combination as having an association as well. And also, it appears to be a durable effect. I mean, a durable association. In other words, when women stop, they go out, there's still an increased risk, association with an increased risk. So I think just something brief should be put in.
I think the key is that it's contemporary use.
Yeah.
Okay. Because sometimes you.
What is, Yeah,
you
see we
that we've changed formulations and now it's, you know, perfectly safe. It's
We have a citation for injectable or implantable progestin only. I guess what I'm trying to say is just because it's in the New England Journal of Medicine doesn't mean we have to cite it. So I would like to see decisions for citation and discussion just based on the quality of the research. This is big, that's good. I'm concerned about the age range, but I can live with that. As long as it's stated, it was, you know, women younger than 50 years of age.
Okay, so Ishmael, you're going to correct a few sentences that capture the sense of it.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
Right, I'll
okay. Okay, now we're up to your paper, another paper, the LTA paper, breast cancer screening.
Right. Yeah, so I think this paper is consistent with a lot of other studies that have shown that overdiagnosis is a major public health problem. So then there were a lot of studies coming out now. I think the most notable was the paper by Blyer and Walsh, came out several years ago, talking about the rates of overdiagnosis in the United States. This shows that that yes, again, just comes up with a figure about 32% is the overdiagnosis rate in the Netherlands program. And basically, it's a population-based study. They looked at patients who've been blind through biannual screening since 1989, when screening started in the Netherlands. But later, from 1989 and 1997, I guess, the screening was extended from the age 30 to 35. And one of the things that they bring out is that the screening has had no effect in decreasing the incidence of stage 2 to 4 breast cancer. And then in the age of 50, or the age of 50, you look at the population data, the incidence of more advanced stage breast cancers is not declined. They attribute the improvement in mortality largely to treatment. So one of the things they bring out is that screening is also within 0.5% reduction in breast cancer mortality over the age of 50, whereas treatment would be associated with about 28% reduction mortality. I think the other point that should be brought out with regards to overdiagnosis, obviously, is that overdiagnosis results in overtreatment, and even though potentially you're reducing cost-specific mortality from screening monitoring, you may potentially be increasing mortality from treatment as a result of overdiagnosis. They don't allude to that, but I think that's the point that's often escaped in regards to the overdiagnosis. In other words, screening results in overdiagnosis, and overdiagnosis results in overtreatment, and therefore you're potentially increasing all-cause mortality. Again, if they don't allude to this, but I think that's the point that we brought out. So even though mammography screening may be reducing breast cancer-specific mortality, the overall effect might be negated by excess and mortality treatment. I think a lot of these types of papers that have come out looking at population-specific ecological studies pointing to this effect, and I don't know if there's really, you know, I don't think this necessarily adds much more to the discussion that we've already had on this topic of overdiagnosis. So that's a major public health problem that certainly the study looking at the Netherlands data seems to support that that as well.
Well, if you think that the data stand are reliable, even if it's only an added reference to say overdiagnosis has been noted in a number of ecologic studies, I happen to be able to.
I think this, again, what this data shows is that the screen does not reduce the advanced breast cancers. So basically, it doesn't reduce the risk of advanced breast cancers. It increases detection rates of early cancers, and so you can calculate overdiagnosis effect by looking at advanced breast cancer not going down, but the early cancers increasing. That is a measure of the potential impact of overdiagnosis in the population. I think they make that point, and I think it's a point. We've seen that here also, here database. The stage 4 breast cancers have not gone down have you seen an increase in lab increase early disease, lab increase in these guys? So, you know, the effect projected in the U.S. is about 33%, and then they go 32% as the overdiagnosis rate in this.
I don't know. I mean, I was on the phone with the breast cancer screening researchers, and they were, like, appalled by this study. Like, these French people took our data and totally misinterpreted it. So they may be coming up with a letter, so we might hold off from this.
Is it next paper?
Oh. Is that it? Well, that's, I mean, a direct letter.
Oh, a direct letter
about this, because they were saying they totally misinterpreted our data.
Sure.
It might have been. Well, sorry.
Yeah, it seems like there's two camps there.
Yeah. What specifically did they say was, we're in the next papers, Harry DeConing, you can count on him to publish that there is no overdiagnosis, but what did they specifically say was wrong?
I mean, just about everything. I didn't give too many details. There's a call about something else.
I'm not sure how they respond to that.
Well, there may be a check for a letter coming soon.
Okay.
On specifically to that analysis, be able to judge
better. What do you think?
There are people out there like Dan Copans at Mass General who didn't count the overdiagnosis phenomenon entirely. You know, they think I think it's very hard to discount because a day like this, and you see, that the advanced cancer has that, the screen has no effect on the advanced cancers, but it increased the obesity. So I think there's a appears to have had a very small impact on population based mortality rates.
Yeah. Well, there are two things. It's hard to get away from the concept of overdiagnosis when, in association with screening, early stage cancers go up and stay up, and late stage cancers are stable and don't grow down, because an indicator of efficacy should be reflected by a reduction in late stage cancer. And this isn't the first paper that shows that, as Ishmael's pointed out. It's hard to get away from the concept of overdiagnosis. Quantifying is a little more difficult. By the way, as an aside, the decrease in breast cancer mortality started at ages under 50, women who are never screened, and prior to any screening, and was the largest for them compared to any of the other age groups. So it's another indicator, indirect, I agree, that treatment plays a very powerful effect in different age range, in across the age spectrum.
You know, another thing I think that hasn't been brought up very frequently in regards to the mortality decline is the fact that ER negative rates have declined. There's been all kinds of hypotheses about that. So there are three things at play here. There's the treatment effect. You know, you have adjuvant therapy starting in the mid-80s. There's the screening. And then, of course, you have the natural biology of the disease is changing. You have a decline and a decrease in ER negative. The effect of screening, it's interesting, the mortality reduction started in the early 90s in basically all the countries in the world, Western countries. But screening takes about 10 years to see the effect. So you could argue in the U.S. maybe, it may have had an effect because screening started in the early 80s in the U.S., but in Europe, screening started in the early 90s, so it was too early to see the effect in Europe. And yet they've seen declines in mortality at the same time we have. So it's very difficult, I think, from the evidence point of view, the randomized trials to pin the declines in breast cancer mortality in Europe to screening, because it occurred too early after the initiation screening. You would have seen the effect 10 years out, but we saw the effect immediately in the early 90s at the same time that we started seeing declines in the United States. So it's probably treatment, maybe the ER negative, change the ER biology that may be attributable to the mortality effect.
Yeah, that's a good point. We don't often enough compare different societies, because treatment actually started around the same time in Western countries, because Western countries themselves were reporting around the same time as we were the efficacy of chemotherapy at relatively earlier stages. And that's a good point.
Yeah, don't discount the tamoxifen.
Exactly. And tamoxifen is pretty easy to give. So
why was it? And we know who got it. And for example, looking forward to the other Dutch study, the age groups. So in 1980, there was this victim from NCI from the overview saying that benefited postmenopausal patients who are estrogen sensitive, and then only later their an understanding that it was also for the younger patients.
Right. So why don't we have Joanne?
Tamoxifen is probably the best drug ever.
Tamoxifen?
Cancer.
Well,
it's catching up.
You think it's up there with aspirin?
Penicillin.
Yeah.
No.
Well, Joanne, maybe you can help this move this discussion along with the De Koning paper.
I'd be happy to go. Lisa, can you pull up table one, figure one? It's three pages in. I find it intriguing, and I suspect that we may indeed be seeing a flurry of back and forth articles and letters as people of like, different interpretations of data from Norway.
No.
I was
asked. From the Netherlands.
Yes, I was asked to review this paper on the Dutch municipalities, and it's population-based. They bragged about how they now have 20 years of follow-up, and in reading it, to get to the bottom line, my general read is that I didn't think we needed to add anything to our topics based upon this, and I was received the email asking me to review this at the same time that the JAMA article came out on the CISPET models. And I said, well, gee, we're going to talk about that paper. So I somehow got signed up for both. So let me stop now and say, can everyone hear me adequately?
Yes.
Okay, great. So I'm going to be very quick on the first paper then. This basically is looking in the Netherlands. They had gradual patients where they started seeing at a municipality level, they would sort of identify a couple of municipalities and which start screening. And there's a lot of other things going on at the same time, though. They say in this paper that they're going to compare screening versus treatment impact, and I found it a bit unappealing. There's all these other things going on. There's the transition to digital mammography. They transition from one view to two view. I found it interesting that the recall rate in this country doubled over this time period. It made me wonder if they're having the same cultural and malpractice and other sort of influences on practice. And then when you look at their method, this is done not at the individual patient level, but at the municipality level. And they actually started out with over 800 municipalities, and then there's mergers, there's acquisitions. And so, you know, it's fine if the municipalities merge together and they all have the same start date for screening, but you know, there were a few that it wasn't as straightforward, where they merged together municipalities that had different calendar years of intervention of screening. So like all studies in elementary, the data that they present is breast cancer death, and it's age of death data from Statistics Netherlands. And as you can see, they divide into a few different age groups. The numbers in Table 1 show that they had 69,000 breast cancer deaths. I didn't quite like them showing denominators. They divide data up and show you for three different age groups, and they also divide data up in regards to when they started screening in the late 80s, early 90s for the early municipalities versus the intermediate versus the late folks. And the late folks, they started screening in 1995 to 97. For their statistical analysis, they basically took a look at the year zero, which is when screening was introduced. And everything is relative to that time So the preceding and subsequent years of minus one, minus two, versus plus one, plus two. And again, you know, they go on about how they have 23 years of follow-up in some of these municipalities. Then they look at trends over time, looking at log linear Poisson regression. If you look there at the figure up on the screen, first the age mortality rate. They show it for the three age groups. The x-axis, you'll see the zero, that's the time point in which at the municipality level screening was introduced. And if you look at the middle group, the sort of 55 to 74 year age group, you'll see that after about 2 years, the mortality stops to drop. And then you'll see for the patients in the 75 to 79, after about 6 or so years, then you get a turning point and the mortality starts to drop. Let me have you move to figure two to show for the group, please, Lisa. In figure two, this shows the relative breast cancer mortality rate, and it's only for the age group that was getting the screening, the 55 to 74 year. Again, the x-axis shows you the zero inflection point where screening was introduced. And then you see the relative breast cancer mortality rate. It starts to go down with the dashed lines representing the 95% confidence intervals. And after about 20 years, you can see it drops about 30%. Now, the figure underneath, figure three, is the one where they try to disentangle the effect of screening versus treatment. And I just found this kind of messy big. This shows the age standardized breast cancer mortality rate for three different groups based upon when screening started, whether they were the early implementers in the late 80s versus the intermediate versus the late group that they finally started screening in 95 to 97. And I guess their hypothesis is that you would have seen a more of a drop in the late group before time zero, because some of the treatment was already available to those people before this inflection point in which they flipped the switch in those specific municipalities and started screening. In thinking about the points they're trying to make here, you know, there's obviously limitations. The data are at the municipality level, not at the individual patient level. And I don't know. I wasn't as innate with their analysis. And in general, I don't feel that we need to add anything to our topic based upon this. Given the previous article, and also Don and some of the other groups interested in this topic, any comments on this paper before we move to the cisnet modeling?
So this is Don. I think it's garbage. If you look at this figure three, or really any of the figures, and you move those lines, making it chronological as opposed to when the screening came in. Screening came in over like a 5 or 6 or 8 year period. But so we're talking about a shift in, you know, of something like 5 or 6 years. And if you move the ones that came in later by that amount, you get, you know, this thing goes up and down all over the place. You get essentially the same thing. It's completely discombobulated with treatment, and I think most of it is treatment.
Joanne, that answers your question, I'll bet.
I thought it was garbage too. Thank you, Don.
Okay. But the more intricate paper, I guess you'd say, complicated, is the one I think Don is on, and that is the modeling paper, right?
That's correct. So why don't we move to that paper, unless there's any other comments about the first?
We're going to go back to Ishmael's paper by Altier after yours, so maybe we can come to some agreement about, well, I think we have perhaps a consensus on the Koning paper, but go ahead with the modeling paper, the JAMA paper.
Okay. This one, as I mentioned, was published, and I just happened to have read the abstract and said that Steve Young discussed this one, not that one I was invited. I tried to talk John into presenting it this morning, and he wants me to at least take a shot, so I'm going to be very brief, and I'll turn it over to John. Let me have Lisa go to the page that you called Amazon. It's three pages in. This is the remarkable SysMed group. We have discussed them many times. Every group uses a common set of inputs, based upon model structure, prior research, a lot of assumptions. And then they have uniqueness and some variability between the models. In regards to their comparison with their earlier work, this brings in information on molecular subtypes, include data from the consortium on digital screening. They have data on recent treatment advances from the National Comprehensive Cancer Network. They have updated incidence and data on competing non-breast cancer mortality. So they've really done a lot of work on this. And for such complex modeling, I wanted to have everyone look at the top of this page, the first paragraph under analysis, because somehow you guys do a good job of simplifying and telling us what you're doing. They basically simulated mortality rates under four intervention scenarios, and they list them here. Scenario one is what would happen over time if there was just no screening or treatment, and that's the baseline mortality rate. Number two is if there was just screening alone, screening mammography. Number three, with treatment alone. And number four is the combined. So I thought they did a marvelous job just very simply describing this. They then in the methods explained how they come up with estimating the separate contributions associated with screening and treatment. And they basically considered the modeled effects of screening alone and of treatment alone, and then as a fraction of the combined modeled effects. Obviously the uncertainty analysis here is you look at the mean, but also the range across the models. And they provide a measure of uncertainty because every model has different assumptions and different structures. There's a lot of unobservable factors that I wish we had more data on. To move to the results, Lisa, let me have you figure one. Figure one, A, B, and C, the x-axis is time from the 70s to 2011, 2012. Figure 1A just shows that women are now getting mammograms. Figure 1B shows that these mammograms are now almost all digital. And Figure 1C shows all the changes over time in systemic treatment of women. Then let me have you show Figure 2. Figure 2 is on the next page. And Figure 2A is the x-axis shows time from the 70s to 2012. And on the y-axis, it's breast cancer mortality rate. You see the results for all of the models here. And we all need some good news. And this is a nice figure, especially in our political climate. You have to smile when you see this mortality reduction. You know, this is your happy figure for the day, in that, you know, fewer women are dying. So that's Figure 2A. Figure 2B is a representative model. Remember, they have six different models, and this is just a representative example of the reverse one of the models. The x-axis, again, is the years, so the y-axis is the mortality rate. And remember, there were four scenarios. And so you can see at the top, dark, is that with no treatment and no screening, mortality rate would go up. And then you see the impact of screening alone, treatment alone, and the combined. And it's interesting, when you look at what's happening between 2000 and 2012, we're getting much more bang for the buck from treatment. And indeed, this group in one of the subsequent tables does a nice job of teasing that out. Then, Lisa, let me have you pull up Table 1 on the next page. Table 1 shows the overall as well as the subtype-specific breast cancer mortality reduction. And this is the results for 2012. So this is at the time period 2012. You'll see, and I'm just going to have you look at the top part. This is the rows. They show the six different models, and then at the bottom, the mean. Because we are screening and prevention, I'm not going to go into the molecular subtypes here, even though it's very cool what they did. I want to just walk you through the results, looking at the mean results. The mortality reduction percent, they show what they think is associated with screening, associated with treatment alone, and then you'll see the 49%, the mean of 49%. That is what the associated mortality reduction is for the combination of screening and treatment, and this is in comparison with the scenario of no screening, no treatment. And so remember this 49% from 2012, because when we go over table 3, this number will be shown again. The next two columns of data, you'll see fraction of combined mortality reduction, and they do a great job of giving you footnotes to explain, you know, what column data are they taking as the numerator, what column data is the denominator. But let me move you to the far right two columns, which is the relative contribution to this combined mortality reduction. So if you're getting a 49% drop because of these two things, what percentage do we think is coming from screening and what percentage is coming from treatment? And the mean here from screening is 37%. The range of findings between these models goes from 26% to 51%. And then on the far right, you see the treatment, and it's thought to be 63%. And here the range is 49% to 74%. You will notice that five of the six models note a larger contribution of treatment to this mortality reduction. And so this is one of their key findings in Table 1. To save time, I'm going to move us on to Table 3. Table 2 just shows the relative contributions to the treatment modality. So go on to Table 3. And again, just look at the top part of Table 3. They show the six models and then the mean. And here, they take a look at just the last 13-year period between 2000 and 2012. And in this first column of data on the mean, you'll see 37%. And that's what they thought the estimated mortality reduction was because of screening and treatment. They thought it was around 37% in 2000. And then in 2012, we seem to be doing better every year, and it got up to 49%. And then they did simple math and took the 49% minus 37%, and you get a change or a difference between those two time periods of 12%. Or 12. And so what they answer in this table is basically, in this last decade or so, about 13 years, how much of that improvement do we think came from improvements in screening technology versus improvements in our treatment? And you'll see the next column is associated with screening advances. The mean there is 17%, and the range is pretty big. It's 2% to 31%. So it's thought that just this small chunk of the reduction is due to screening. And then the next three columns show the what the estimated mean and then the model-specific reductions are, the relative contributions are from each of the three types of treatment. And if you add up those means for those three columns, the 38, the 29, and the 15, you get 83%. And then the range there is 69 to 98%. So the majority of the improvement over this time period between 2000 and 2012 is thought to be due to treatment improvement. Everyone is very familiar with these CISNET models. There's a lot of assumptions and the input parameters. The models extrapolated long-term survival. The treatment effects, they're based on efficacy, I think, in trials that were in the Oxford overview. And so there might be some overestimation of, you know, that compared to my own patients. And other minor things, like, you know, they only considered 5 years of hormone therapy. Progesterone receptor status was missing from a lot of data sources. We don't have information on the racial ethnic subgroups. and things like the effect of screening and subtype specific treatment on morbidity and all cause mortality wasn't evaluated. And then knows what it would look like in 2018. But I just thought that this was such a superior piece of work compared to the other article I'm sure you. So thank you for letting me add it to today's discussion. Let me turn it over to Don.
So I really essentially nothing to add. You did a great job. It is a little bit interesting, this figure that you have up here. Actually, it's a lot interesting that Herceptin, trastuzumab, has such a dramatic effect. And of course, it's being given to a minority of patients, maybe 5% of patients, and yet it translates into this really substantial improvement in mortality for the HER2-positive patients. I said earlier something about tamoxifen being a great drug. It'll soon be taken over by Herceptin and the other anti-HER2 therapies. It is now better to have a HER2-positive tumor. So maybe Ishmael will disagree with that. But it has a HER2-positive tumor precisely because it's such a great therapy for it. But thank you very much. A great job, John.
So now we have the package of three papers. I'll make a proposal. I think the sense of the room was not to refer to the second paper because of the issues of trouble interpreting it. What we have, I think, will be a consensus that we at least refer to the CISNET modeling paper, which, by the way, the quantitative, which couldn't, in my opinion, this is oversimplifying, but if you look at changes in mammography over the decades, it's hard to defend a statement that the mammography is getting better and better and better and better. It's pretty much the same technology, and even the switch from film to digital is questionable whether that really improved mammography efficacy. But there is no question, based on scores of randomized trials, that chemotherapy has gotten better and better and better and continues to improve as it diffuses into the population. So this sort of establishes that that is what is going on. But now getting back to the first paper.
Can I just add to that?
Yeah.
You know, something I mentioned before that is really an incredibly non-intuitive thing, but it's true. Let's suppose there were no advances and we're looking at breast cancer, and we just sit back on our laurels and continue where we are today. Breast cancer mortality would actually turn around and start to increase. And so the only way you can, and there's a good reason for that, it's too complicated to go into, but, and Ishmael knows about this, if you don't have additional advances, it's going to increase. So what we're seeing here is precisely what Barry is just saying. It's the advances, and the advances are almost exclusively in treatment.
So I think I heard we include a reference and discussion of the CISNET paper, but we also include the BMJ paper, the OTA paper, even though it's sort of says pretty much the same thing as most population-based studies that have recently come out are saying, if only to just put in as an extra reference of, you know, multiple studies in different locations are showing that there's a substantial amount of overdiagnosis in association with screening with no... well, what do you feel? You know, the mortality, even in that paper, mortality was dropping fastest and most in the people who were not even invited to screen. That's another treatment effect. So, Ishmael, do you want to craft something?
So the Augier paper is very similar to Blair and Walsh, if I think about it, they almost the same number over that same figure for overdiagnosis, about 32%.
Yes.
So I think it would be nice just to mention that, because this is another study showing substantial overdiagnosis associated with screen monitoring.
Okay, very good.
I've got a question.
Yeah.
Comment. So basically, you've got three papers describing three observational types of analyses, all of which have questions and concerns and assumptions and so on, as has been mentioned. And certainly the first two are talking about the same database, and the Netherlands, and they come to somewhat different, very different conclusions. So what is it about the second paper, the sand testing paper, that we find so objectionable?
I'm not even certain where to start. Don, what are your thoughts?
Apparently, that's Phil, I think.
Yes, it's Phil. I'm just saying that all the papers are making assumptions, and there are concerns about the one could raise concerns about all the analyses. So why is this one so much worse?
The simple thing is that what they're drawing conclusions on, of course, and they recognize, confounds screening and treatment. And what they do is they focus on a particular point. Like I could say, I'd like to look at the first time in the 90s that the American League won the World Series. It's over that period of time where they're not really removing the confounding. And the big problem is to, as Barry indicated earlier, treatment and screening came in at about the same time, certainly in the United States, but also in the Netherlands. And if you move it a little bit, you get the same picture. And so it's drawing this zero point that's the big problem. And if you just look at the chronology when treatment came into the various age groups, you get the same picture. So it's a bogus analysis.
I think there's other reasons for not wanting to include it. This paper does not bring any new information overall that's not currently discussed or addressed. Just because it was discussed today doesn't mean it has to be included in that. We just did a major overhaul of the breast cancer topic and realized that everybody kept adding, a new paragraph with every paper we discussed, and it gets unwieldy. So I think there's other reasons for why not wanting to include it as well.
What does the SYSNET paper add in terms of, and both these papers seem to be saying there's observational data that screening has been effective in reducing mortality, which we may have already known. So, what does the SYSNET paper add specifically?
I think it adds the fact that over time we're not getting remarkable improvements with the technology affecting visual and tomosynthesis. We have a section in this topic on statistical modeling, and I think it would be helpful there just to point out how screening may be beneficial if treatment is now becoming more and more so.
So, Bill, one of the things it does is it updates the joint indicator, what was about before, and so we've got something already about the result up to the year 2000. And the apportionment of screening and treatment and the uncertainty associated with it and the very possible models. And what this does is, of course, it looks at the HER2 and ER category. It updates that, says that what is responsible for the decline since 2000 up until 2012 is moving toward the treatment side. So it's what Barry focused on about the advances in treatment and how this is showing that the benefit is translating into the population, at least by way of the model.
Okay.
The chapter's not about here.
No, but it is about the relative contribution of screening versus treatment. There is no question that they're intimately related. And I think it's fair to say that as treatment gets better and better and better, then screening loses its relative importance until ultimately you achieve the same efficacy as with, let's say, testicular cancer, where no matter how much you screen, the therapy is so good that it can't possibly make an impact. Screening can't make an impact. So I think this is just sort of an indication of that phenomenon.
So Barry, if you look at the randomized trials of screening, from a historical perspective, if you take the face value, HIV has the most robust effects.
Yeah.
And then you had the Swedish two county, but since the introduction of adjuvant systemic therapy, there's been no benefit of screening. I mean, the Canadian two study, the UK AIDS trial, none of these trials, post adjuvant systemic therapy show any benefit of screening.
Yeah.
So that's entirely consistent with the fact that there's a treatment interaction.
Right.
And the treatments have gotten better. We basically got to the point where we're not having any benefit from screening.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, the whole section on screening, I mean, are we saying that now screening is not effective at all? I mean, that's a huge
I don't think we said that.
No, but that's what he's saying. Basically, at this point of treatment, 20 years ago, it's no longer beneficial in terms of mortality benefit.
No,
screening. That's what he just said.
That's not what the Cisnet paper said.
No, that's what he just said.
I'm suggesting that if you look at the trials in historical perspective, I mean, you can right. interpret the trend in that manner. I mean, there's obviously a decreasing benefit over time when technology's gotten better. Well, obviously, technology's gotten better, yet we see a diminution in the effect of screening over time.
So
what's the play here? I mean, you have to wonder if it's these are randomized trials showing this diminishing benefit over time.
It's certainly not clear that if you keep screening the same and introduce new therapies, the effect of screening is going to dissipate. It is a possibility is that, so I mentioned Herceptin, it is a possibility that the new drugs that are coming in are very effective, and they're very effective in the earlier cancers, and the earlier you get the cancers. So screening, the interaction can go in the other direction. It can be a synergy.
That's certainly a possibility, yes.
All right, but we're not going to say, I don't think anyone said we're going to claim that screening no longer works at all. It's just a relative to treatment, the treatment advances have become proportionately more responsible for the reduction in mortality. Okay, now, Jill, cancer screening overview. Jill, are you on mute?
Yeah, sorry, it took me a minute to unmute myself.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. So, Lisa, would you mind throwing the article up, please? This is an article entitled Asymptomatic Pancreatic Cancer and Incidental Detection Impacting Long-Term Outcomes. And it's, I thought, a difficult article which reaches conclusions that are not supported by its data and that I don't believe merits an edit or addendum to any of our summaries. It is a retrospective study from a large Japanese cancer center
of 569 consecutive patients with pancreatic adenocarcinoma, and its objective is to determine whether there is a survival benefit to the detection of pancreatic adenocarcinoma when asymptomatic and incidental. And principally, it compares two groups, those which are asymptomatic and those which are symptomatic. So, with up to 565 consecutive patients, 319 were unresectable, and 215 were resectable. All of the patients were tumor factors, and demographic factors were cataloged so that they could be compared. That would be demographics, both tumor locations, pathologic stage, treatment, and overall survival. And you can see in the results section that the paper claims that one-third, 29% of patients present without symptoms, which is a very, very high percentage, and that of these, there's a statistically significant higher survival benefit and also a higher resectability rate. But in the very next sentence, it states that of those patients who were resected, there was no difference in the possibility of complete resection or five-year survival between the symptomatic and the asymptomatic patients, which I think is a very important point because it has been a given in pancreatic cancer management and care that complete resection is essentially the key to long-term survival and the potential for cure. So that's the overview, and I'll dig into it in a little more detail. But before going to the data chart, I'd just like to point out some of the presumptions and some of the problems and misleading facts. First, the article maintains that asymptomatic that patients remain asymptomatic until they have advanced disease. That's presented as a non-contestable fact. But in fact, that's not true. And they state in the paper that it's not true because many small tumors of pancreatic head are asymptomatic, are symptomatic, though non-advanced, because they produce ductal obstruction and jaundice, etc. Secondly, they claim that this is a very important issue because of the significantly increased incidence of the detection of asymptomatic incidental pancreatic adenocarcinoma, and they cite several papers, but they're conflating two issues. They're conflating the true dramatic increase in the incidental detection of asymptomatic cystic pancreatic tumors, non-adenocarcinomas of the pancreas, with incidental adenocarcinoma. Third, their principal outcome is, quote, long-term outcome, but they never define long-term outcome. The assumption is that it refers to overall survival, mean overall survival, or five-year survival, but they use those terms imprecisely, so that it's not clear which they're referring to in their conclusion. Fourth, overall survival is imprecisely measured by death or last follow-up, and those dates are variable. Their rate of incidental pancreatic adenocarcinoma, of incidental asymptomatic pancreatic adenocarcinoma, of almost 30%, is extremely high. They're originating to Japan, and their and some of the practice patterns that they describe in the paper, and not generalizable. So those are some of the patterns. And then, and in addition, they do include a few patients who receive neoadjuvant chemo, in other words, chemo preoperatively at other institutions. So there's some selection bias. And 23% of the asymptomatic patients had other cancers. And the effect of those cancers on the patient's survival isn't considered or can't be determined. And moreover, the treatment, the post-operative treatment, the adjuvant therapy the patients received is not standardized. It's inconsistent, and it's based in large part on patient tolerance. So all of these things are confounders that really can't be controlled for, or at least many of those things are confounders that can't be controlled for. And then diving more deeply into the data that the patient that supported them.
Wait, I wanted to add, is it all of this just the return? That is, there's no difference at all just because of the symptomatic?
Well, they go on to conclude at the end of the paper, which I've had a chance to get to, and but you can certainly jump to that on pages 1294 in the near the bottom of the left hand column, and also on page 1293 explicitly that it's not baseline bias or tumor biology. But what I was hoping to show by going through the data is that that's a conclusion that they can't reach based on their data. For example, on page 1294, well, actually probably on 1293, they say at the bottom of the page, although overall survival for pancreatic resection was similar between the symptomatic and the asymptomatic patients in the cohort, our comparison of pathologic features between resected asymptomatic and symptomatic tumors suggests that the higher resectability, I'm skipping down, occurs because of the increased opportunity for surgical intervention. So basically, it's a circular reasoning. It's a begging the question. They're saying that the higher resectability is a result of higher resectability, which is ridiculous. But in addition, they make it very clear at the beginning of the paper that resectability is not equivalent to tumor-free margins, with RO, you know, like, which is the most important predictor, at least thus far, of our understanding of who is likely to do well. And then they go on to say that it's speculation is supported by the fact that survival was similar between asymptomatic patients to an unresectable disease and those who were symptomatic. And then getting back to your point about whether this is late-time bias, on the last page, 1294, near the bottom, they say, for a survival advantage obtained by early diagnosis in an asymptomatic state is real. So they're basically presenting their conclusion as a given. And then they claim that it's, in the next sentence, they say, primarily due to improved resectability and unlikely a reflection of recon bias or selection bias with favorable biology. So I think there are many inconsistencies within the paper. Did that answer the question?
It answers my question.
I think
it answers my question to the affirmative. That is, yes,
okay.
It's recurring.
Yeah, well, I actually said put a note.
It might be more than lead time.
Yes. I said...
And it's probably tumor biology as well.
Yeah.
If by tumor biology you mean length bias canceling. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so... there are a couple of other things I'd like to add to this, which is interesting. First of all, they reach a conclusion that there is some particularly significant overall survival benefit between asymptomatic and symptomatic patient cohorts, separate from those who are all comers, regardless of whether they are resectable. But that benefit is really pretty small. It's a 6-month median overall survival benefit. And a 6% survival benefit of all comers regardless of surgery. That's figure 1 on page 1291. Figure 2 on 1293 compares the surgical results of the asymptomatic and symptomatic patients. And at the top of that page, they take all comers, all patients who undergo surgery. In the middle chart, they compare those patients who undergo a Whipple, then the word these patients have cancers in the head or neck or unsedate, and therefore require a temporary duodenectomy. And the last chart, are those patients who undergo distal pancreatectomy, and in none of those groups is there a survival benefit for asymptomatic patients who present without symptoms. I'd like to show you a couple other things that I think are kind of interesting and maybe elucidating, especially to those people who don't practice abdominal imaging or see a lot of it. Lisa, would you mind putting up the images that I sent you? Okay, could you start with the ultrasound? Okay, so this was a very interesting case that came across my desk not long ago. This is a patient who presented with an incidental, very small, pancreatic adenocarcinoma. It's the little area that has the cursors around it. And I'm sure that, Lisa, can you share the screen so that I can use can I use my arrow here?
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible? Okay, let's see if it lets me. It says I'm presenter, but I no longer have the image.
Yeah, so you'll have to share your screen.
Okay.
Which you would have to have
so
the images.
Do that.
You'd have to have the images pulled up on your screen.
I got you. Okay, so I have them in my email. Maybe.
Maybe you can just direct me. Yeah.
I'll direct you. That'd be easier. Okay, sure. So let's flip back then, if you don't mind. So I still don't have the images on that. There we go. Okay. So, and would you mind unmagging a little bit? Okay. So at the top of the screen, the very top, where we see the there we go. That's the skin surface. And the very bottom of the screen would be the deep portion of the abdomen and the vertebral bodies. And the area that's identified by the cursors is a small pancreatic adenocarcinoma in the pancreatic head. It actually is a body/head junction. And so this is a patient who came in with a history of abnormal liver function tests, which we see all the time, and he does have a fatty liver, and incidentally he has this pancreatic lesion, and it's not specific based on ultrasound, although it's concerning based on its immune appearance. And on EUS, endoscopic ultrasound, this was a pancreatic adenocarcinoma. And the way I became aware of this is that I happened to be reading the patient's follow-up post-therapy MRI, restaging MRI. And when I was reading the MRI, I went back to look at the prior studies for comparison. That's routine. And there were none. But this ultrasound, could you mind switching to the CT? So on the basis of this ultrasound, the surgeon, who is a pancreatic, a hepatobiliary surgeon, a Sloan Kettering fellowship trained hepatobiliary surgeon, determined, based on that ultrasound, that the patient wasn't resectable, never staged him, never did the thin-cut multi-detector dynamic post-contrast CT that you see here, that is just essential to determine whether the patient's resectable, especially given the fact that this was a really small lesion, and it really did look as though he might be curable. There was no extension into the fat at the margins of the pancreas. Alicia, do you see the first image on the left, the curvilinear white thing in the middle of the image? Further to your right, that's the splenic artery, and it just happens because of the image to be in the middle of the pancreas. And if you the curvilinear structure that's extending on either side of that is the pancreas. Can you go to the left a little bit? That's the line that he ducts right there. That darker thing. So the patient had a duct cut off, but you couldn't see the tumor. He had one of these small percentages of cancers that aren't visible. We call them isodeaths, about 11% of the pancreatic adenocarcinoma. And he had to study only because I called the oncologist and I said, I'm reading a restaging MR, but he's not had a staging CT. And based on the imaging findings, the ultrasound in the MR, he might actually be someone who's resectable. So they went back, they did do the staging CT. It looked as though he could be resectable based on very standard criteria that were used in this article. But in fact, at surgery, he was unresectable. So that's one of the problems with these things. Even when they really should be resectable, they may not be. And not only that, when they're resectable, in other words, when they have clean margins, when they have no evidence of either microscopic or macroscopic disease at the margins, and when the nodes are negative, although that is the best predictor of survival, it's still a very unreliable predictor of survival. And one other kind of interesting thing that I wanted to share that I think is relevant is this fact. I happened to call a surgeon at Hopkins named John Cameron, who's done more pancreatic cancer surgery than anyone in the world, and more Whipples than anyone in the world. He's in his 70s. He's done, I think it's more than 3,000, it's certainly more than 2,000. And in his hands, Whipple has mortality has decreased from 30% to between 1% and 2%. It's actually astounding. And I said, is there something new that of which I may be unaware? For example, is it no longer true that curative resection is agreed, widely agreed to be the best predictor of long-term survival? And he said, no, that's still true. But he said something else, and I ran through a couple things in the paper, and he agreed that they were inconsistent, and I was wondering if there was a hole in what I was understanding based on some broader knowledge of pancreatic cancer care that I didn't know, and that I couldn't find doing a search, which I did do. And he said there was no such thing. But he did tell me something extremely interesting, which is that he has a new cohort of patients who have had positive margins at surgery, who should not have survived, who are living 5 to 10 years out from their surgery. And he's not yet published this. He's just petition to present it at the American Surgical Society, although he said that he was declined incredibly. But that causes him, and of course this is not proven yet, to think that not that there is some other biologic tumor factor that is responsible for long-term survival that's unrelated to resectability. So I know that is inconclusive, but I think it supports the conclusion that this paper's conclusions aren't well supported.
Jill, Let me just tell you what I wrote at the top of the paper, because in the interest of time, maybe we should move on. At the top of the paper, I wrote two notes to myself. This is a single-center retrospective study, which already is a problem. And then I said, elevates length-biased sampling to a screening recommendation. And that's, I think, what you were getting at, that the underlying biology...
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. And so I think that's great as a teaching case. I think alerts us to the possibility that if we go run off in all directions screening for pancreatic cancer, we have to expect some element of overdiagnosis or length bias sampling. And even in a cancer that is supposed to be the biggest killer of them all, in terms of case fatality.
What section was this paper supposed to go in? For the pancreatic screening section?
So it went into screening overview.
Yeah, it'll be the overview. Yeah. So I think we can describe that as it's just a teaching case with respect to what can get into the literature, what can get past reviewers and editors. I guess you'd agree with that, Jill.
Yeah, I would. And it's interesting that this author is, the author of many, many similar papers. And I noticed that he happened to have a virtually the same exact paper published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. This was the Journal of Gastrointestinal Surgery, but he published the same exact paper in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. So he's getting a lot of...
That's fraud. Okay. Okay. Should we perhaps move on then? That's very interesting. I think that shows a lot about pancreatic cancer. Kevin, cervical cancer screening. We're starting to run short on time, but can you go through the two papers quickly? Kevin? Is he on mute? Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, now we can hear you.
Hello.
Hi.
Okay. I'm sorry, I just muted myself accidentally. So, can you go to page 315? That's where the action is for this particular paper. This is an older paper. Originally, the only human papillomavirus test we had was a pancreatic cancer, which is HPV2 in a paper, and that's kind of been the gold standard for the 3 or 4 tests that have been after as far as screening. And so this was a 10-year-old paper that looked at amplicore, and so pancreatic cancer is what it says it is, but amplicore is an amplified test, as are all the other tests that have kind of been. And so in this paper, they compared the newer test, the amplicore test, to the established test that's about 20 years old now, the pancreatic cancer test. And as you can see there in that paragraph in the upper left, the Kaplan statistic is 0.73. The place where they have problems with discordant results are with multiple infection and with two certain types of HPV, 53 and 66. And so the hybrid capture actually does a reasonable job with 66 and 53 because it has some cross hybridization, but also has some specificity issues for that same problem. So the amplicore is probably a more sensitive test overall because it does amplify DNA, but whether that's a functional advantage or not is something we always debate. So, do you want to talk about the next paper, which I think we've talked about before, the Thomas Dr. Wright paper with the Athena study, the end of the Athena study?
Oh.
So this was published in... Go ahead.
Well, as we've talked about before, that's good news. Then you can just direct us to what we did about it.
Okay, I think all the action we could probably do in one of these. Let's go to table 2, that's on page 195.
Mm-hmm.
This could have been presented a little more clearly because it's kind of a busy table, but all the action is kind of on the right hand right hand side that down a little bit over table two is where I'm going to go. So this was a huge trial, $40,000. Women who were involved in three different screening strategies, the psychology-only screening strategy, a hybrid strategy, which is really what we do most of the time now, as of the past 5 or 10 years, and an HPV primary study where HPV is the primary test for finding pre-cancer. And so if you look at that CIN pre-plus column, you can see the sensitivities and specificities there as you go down that column for the 25 and over and the 30 and over. I think the bottom line is they're all specific, and the HPV primary screening strategy is more sensitive. However, one of the reasons it's more sensitive is it sends more women to the next step, so it'll have to be. And we have considered that to be a harm of screening and over-screening because that involves an invasive procedures, biopsies, extra expertise. And so this has been somewhat controversial in the field because of that particular reason. So this is the only test, the Roche test, that went through the FDA to get a primary screening indication. I don't know how widely it's been taken up. It's only been on the market a couple of years and has a couple of competitors that came out about the same time, but it is the only one right now in the USA that FDA approved for this indication.
Because I think the test, or didn't the test for us basically say primary screening with HPV is acceptable now?
Well, it's equal,
women
to the specificity to some of the other strategies. So, I'm an author on some interim guidelines to help clinicians. So, is the task force guidelines finalized, or they were still asking?
I think they're draft form. What they said was they switched the first time to HPV as the primary test for women 30 and above.
So there's only one test. There's only one study that I just talked about that has looked at that in an American population in an FDA approval type format. So. We can certainly change our verbiage around to match that, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think, and I believe the Shipman paper is starting to get at that issue, too, that is suggesting HPV as the initial screen is okay. The task force did some modeling, too, as part of their, to come to the conclusions. But at some point, soon, very soon, maybe using the paper that you just presented, I think we need to put that in because it is it's going to be likely the primary recommendation of the test force for women 30 and above.
Well, I think we can present the evidence around it. We don't need to take a stand one way.
No, we wouldn't take a stand, but we can say that the risk of a subsequent CIN 3+. Is extremely low with HPV as the single initial screen if it's negative.
Yeah.
Okay? Can you work with that, Kevin?
Okay,
and take a look. They have their draft. They have their draft statement online, and you'll see what they did, why they said it, but I think there's sufficient accumulating evidence that led them to that conclusion, at least. And I know for the longest time, Doug Lowy has been saying the test force is behind the times. Okay, let me see what time it is. Oh, we only have 5 minutes. Larissa, can you cover this paper in 5 minutes, or should we defer the papers until next time? What am I to talk to us next time?
I can do this in less than 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
I'm going to have a further discussion later about how all of these fit together and how we want to update the guidelines in general, but I can cover this quickly.
Good, thank you.
So this paper is coming out of the Netherlands. It's going to be the theme for the day, and this is looking at high-risk TB detection and self-sampling compared to physician in a responder population of the Dutch cervical screening program. So I'll skip through some of the background. A lot of the self-sampling studies have really been performed previously in populations that have poor access to care or in a non-responding population. So what I think sets this study apart is that it was performed in a population of patients who present for cervical cancer screening. The primary outcome was to investigate concordance in the high-risk HPV positivity as well as HPV 16 and 18 genotypes, which are considered the highest risk, between self-collected samples as well as physician-taken samples, with the secondary objective of acceptability of sampling among a responder population, which again is a little bit different than previous studies. Of note, the self-sample was always taken after the physician-taken sample based on requirements by the Dutch government, and referral was based on the outcome of cytology assessment, not on the obtained high-risk HPV results. So those are kind of the important caveats. So we'll kind of skip over to the primary outcomes. Again, if we look at the patient group, there are 2,460 women who participated. They took out patients who were excluded for a variety of reasons, including invalid specimens, and a total of 2,049 women. So the high-risk HPV prevalence was 8% in this population, which was a little bit higher than what they anticipated. They anticipated about a 5% high-risk HPV prevalence. So it was 8% among physician-taken samples and 10% among the self-samples. Not surprisingly, the high-risk HPV prevalence in both the physician as well as the self-sample decreased the age from about 18 to 20% in the 29 to 33-year-old age group compared to 4.7 to 5.9% in the 59 to 63. Overall, they found the concordance between the self-sampling and physician-taken samples to be 90.8%. You can see details of that in Table 1. They did the McNamara test for related proportions, and they felt that it was significant for a difference between self-sampling and physician sampling in overall high-risk HPV tests, but not significant in looking at the highest-risk HPV 16 and 18 types. So they felt like the differences in proportions were mainly caused by non-16 or 18 high-risk HPV subtypes. They had only 21 patients that had CIN 2 or above identified on physician obtained sampling. And if you look at it, there was two CIN 3 results that were missed on the self sample. So they were negative high-risk HPV on the self sample and positive in the physician sample, which led to the reflex cytology. In terms of acceptability, 89% of the questionnaires were returned. They had an excellent return rate on that. And what they found was that 92% of women did it at home, and only 7% did it at the physician's office immediately afterwards. The user friendliness was rated as good to excellent by 98.5% of the women. Only 0.8% reported uncertainty about performing the test correctly. 99.2% women were very confident in that they performed the self-sampling correctly. The last part of this, overall, the majority of patients, 63%, preferred self-sampling, and this is in a population, again, that goes to the doctor for sampling. 12% had their preference, and 25% preferred physician smears. And convenience was rated excellent. So, in conclusion, I think that this adds to the literature, or sort of to our understanding of the broad topic of cervical cancer screening in general, and that it demonstrates a preference for self-screening in a screened population. But I think
consultant there, we could potentially add this as a reference in our current guideline, as most of the discussion on self-samples is really done in low-income or low-resource settings in our current guidelines. There is high prevalence between the self-sampling and physician-rated samples. I think where there's still weaknesses or where this is still early is that when you cannot do reflex cytology on the self-sample, you can only do it on a physician sample. And so the subsequent steps are not clear in terms of what the recommendation would be.
Okay, so I think it's a good idea to at least put it as a reference. You mentioned a shortcoming, which is the self-collection always came after physician collection, and I know the people here in the Cancer Institute are a bit uneasy whenever it's always in a prescribed order, because one test may affect the next.
Right. And think I was worried about that, like maybe the first test, you know, exfoliated things and made it more likely to pick up each in the self-sample.
Mm-hmm.
I felt a little bit better when I saw that 93% were done at home, but we don't know what their time interval is. Like, did they go home the same day and do it? Did they wait a month?
Yeah.
And that was not discussed in the paper.
Okay, maybe that should be stated as a potential shortcoming. I will say that I've heard, you may know far better than I, the FDA won't accept self-collection as a screening test aimed at women who won't go to their gynecologist, you know, who don't go to the gynecologist. They will only accept tests that are for the entire population, and that has made them gun-shy of approving self-collection tests that have been proposed to them. And so that's a very high bar to clear, because I think that the GYN community would feel very, very uncomfortable saying that, yes, this is, you can self-collect or come to me for the test.
I think that they sort of bring up that that's not really discussed is the too much in the discussion is the fact that they actually have a higher uptake of high risk, or they a higher rate of detection of high risk CDs in the self sample, which actually samples not just the cervix but the cervix and the vagina. So it's unclear how it would lead to more interventions that are not necessarily correlated with CIN3.
Okay.
Because you're picking up the vaginal infection.
Great. So Larissa, do you mind crafting some language, but try to steer clear of the political sensitivity of hinting that this now replaces physician collection, okay?
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right. Okay. I think time's up?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, thank you. Next time, I think we're going to have to move the remaining couple papers to the very top. Mark Chipman's paper actually follows on to the HPV with a single screening test and that will be important.
Hopefully we'll see you all in person next time.
Yes.
And again, you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks to the medical students for persevering.
How is it?